With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to Friday. This is First Things First. I'm Jana Wolf. That is Nick Wright hanging out with us today. Chris Canty and Chris Mannix. That's going to be confusing.
What up,
but, you know,
what up,
we'll go last names
good
only.
To see you.
I like you without a tie. I like this Friday no tie thing you got going.
I didn't get the memo, though, Jenna.
No, you didn't. No, these two did.
For me, it was somewhat random. Mannix never rocks a tie.
Mannix. I do rock ties. It's just I've been on the road too long. I don't have a second one.
Oh, okay.
It's here yesterday. You got my one tie yesterday.
Oh, you were wearing a tie yesterday.
Yes.
My apologies. I forgot.
Come on.
My bad.
There you go.
It's just I just wear what's laid out for me. I have no say in these
things. We got a ton to break down from yesterday's NBA trade deadline. We're going to start this morning with the action on the court. The new look, small ball Houston Rockets. Paid the Lakers a visit last night. How about this? With Clint Capella traded away, there was nobody over 6'6 in the Rockets' starting lineup. And it worked. Russell Westbrook put up 41. New addition, Robert Covington chipped in 14, including 4-for-7 from three. He was clutch down the stretch. Houston went 19-for-42 from deep as a team, beating the Lakers by a final of 121-111. Here is James Harden after the win.
Yeah, we're not smaller. We just, I mean, obviously height-wise, but, you know, heart. Each individual got, you know, big hearts, and we can compete with anybody.
All right, Nick, can the Rockets string a bunch of these wins together playing small ball like this? Can they make some postseason noise this way?
Well, stringing wins together, I think they're going to be a very difficult matchup in the regular season because you don't have time to change your defensive orientation. You don't have time to scheme for them on a night-in, night-out basis like you will in the postseason when you have 2 weeks to dig in on what they do. Listen, this was a 112-111 game with 3 minutes left when LeBron gets the and one, and then three consecutive bad offensive possessions by LeBron lead to the Rockets going on, what, a 10-0 run, a 9-0 run, pardon me, to finish the game and end up beating the Lakers by 10. But here's what I know. If you're going to beat this Rockets team, you are going to have to crush them on the glass. They played the Lakers dead even on the glass. They are going to beat you from three. They beat the Lakers by 10 threes last night. That's a 30-point margin from three. If you do not make up for that on the glass, at the free throw line, points in the paint, by an enormous margin, you're not going to be able to take advantage of where their weaknesses are. So, listen, I'm higher on the Rockets than just about anybody outside of maybe Daryl Morey, James Harden, and Russell Westbrook. I think this is a dangerous, tough team before the Capella trade. I do think going further all in on small ball is an intriguing experiment. If there was any team out west built to take advantage of it, it was the team they played yesterday, and the Lakers were not able to take advantage of it. So, listen, I think the Rockets are going to be a headache for anybody. I do think they are more likely to be a dominant final 30 games of the regular season team than postseason team because it's like facing a knuckleballer all of a sudden in a you know, once a month in baseball. You don't really have time to prepare for it like you will in the postseason.
Yeah, and you can beat up on that Houston team in the postseason. Right now, everything is kind of working for them that needs to be working. The last four games, the rebounding's been okay, especially against the Lakers, but they've been able to hold their own on that end. Russell Westbrook, over the last couple of months, has finally decided, look, I'm not a three-point shooter, so I'm just going to go to the basket every single time, only averaging, I think, a couple of threes per game over the last few weeks. So that's working for them. Robert Covington in his debut could not have been better. The three-point shooting was there, but his defensive versatility showed in that game. He was switching on everything, so he was excellent in that one. But I am concerned long-term about the rebounding issues this team is going to have, and teams will take advantage of you. They will beat you down in the paint. We saw a couple of examples of when the Lakers finally were able to get the ball into Anthony Davis and not turn the ball over, he was able to dominate on that end of the floor. So I don't know if the Lakers are going to go 1-for-11 from three ever again in a matchup like that. LeBron won't have 2-point fourth quarters ever again like that. So I think things are working now, but I do have long-term concerns about Houston.
Well, here's the deal, Mannix. I mean, when you look at this Houston Rockets team, it was clear that they had to do something because as constituted before this week, they didn't have enough to beat the Clippers or the Lakers. And everybody understands that the Western Conference runs through L.A. They can beat up on Denver. They can beat up on Utah. They can beat up on OKC. But if you want to advance to the NBA Finals, you're going to have to go through Staples. And to me, I think the unconventional approach is a calculated risk that Daryl Morey and Mike D'Antoni had to take because D'Antoni wants to play with pace, and being able to swap out Capella and bring in Robert Covington allows you to do that, adding him with Daniel House and Eric Gordon and Cephalosha and Rivers and McLemore, all of those guys coming off the bench. It just seems like it makes sense. And you're going to allow some points in the paint to opposing bigs, but the philosophy is that those bigs will have a tougher time covering their wing players on the offensive end than they would being able to collapse on those guys defensively. So you're going to be able to dictate the game by being able to run with pace. And then ultimately at the end of the game, you're hoping that the first three quarters takes its toll yep. and limits the effectiveness of those opposing big men.
Didn't last night show you that if the Lakers are the team they're going to have to beat in the West, that they can do it?
Well, they can do it in nights when they hit 10 more threes and then right. in nights when they are even rebounding with them.
Which is the assumption going with this lineup?
Well, the assumption is the threes. The assumption is the threes, not that they will draw even rebounding. Like, the Lakers got 6 offensive rebounds yesterday. Mm-hmm. That can't happen. When you're playing a team that everyone is 6'6 or below, and LeBron was not particularly good. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of teams, by the way, can beat the Lakers in nights when LeBron goes 1 of 8 from three, where he has, like I said, it's 112, 111. Then Robert Covington hits an impossible corner three. Anthony Davis is draped all over him. It felt like that was about a 10% shot when he took it, but he made it. Then it's LeBron turnover, LeBron missed three. That's bad. And by the way, I'll be the first to say it, LeBron was bad down the stretch in this game. He was bad down the stretch, you could argue, in both of the Clipper games. He needs to be better in the playoffs in those spots. This is an experiment for Houston, and it's an unprecedented one. I understand why they're doing it. I think they understand, even with James and Russ, they are not as good as the Lakers. They might not be as good as the Clippers. So they need to shake the snow globe a bit and see if they can add variance to a playoff series. It also could lead to them getting blown out in the first round. It could lead to them facing a Denver or Utah team that they just can't match up with. But it also, I think, gives them the only real shot they have of making their first NBA Finals in a quarter century.
Here's the biggest question they have to address. They're going to be able to score on anybody. They'll put up
150. And they already were the number two scorer.
Already, right? Yep. But they went up against the Lakers and were really good defensively against the top 5 offensive team. In the last 3 games, in the fourth quarter, they're only giving up less than 20 points per game. Yep. They gave up 2 second chance points in the last 3 games in the fourth quarter. If those numbers hold up, they can go to the NBA Finals. Like, that's how good the Rockets can be. But those numbers, to me, feel more like the exception rather than the rule. This is still a team that is vulnerable defensively on the inside. This is still a team that's going to give up a whole bunch of second chance points. So I'm going to need to see this over a month, 2 months, before I buy into the Rockets as a team that can compete.
Yeah, of course it's a risk. We don't know if it's going to work in the postseason, but this is how D'Antoni wants to play. And the one thing I do like about it is that it accentuates the strengths of your best players, James Harden and Russell Westbrook, because all of a sudden now those guys got room to work because the opposing teams have to worry about those other guys that are solid perimeter shooters. Everybody on this roster, the guys that they're playing in this rotation, are solid to good knockdown shooters. So I think that creates open lanes for those guys to get in the paint. You saw it last night with Russell Westbrook dropping 41. He's on an incredible streak. He's got, 24 straight games, over 20 points. And then James Harden last night was a slow night for him, but he's coming off of back-to-back 40-point performances. So I think that this is a calculated risk, but it was a necessary chance that they had to take, and they're going for it. They're pushing all their chips to the table. We'll see if this style is able to have success once we get to playoff basketball.
And you mentioned it. One of the reasons I liked the Russ trade before the year wasn't just you get off CP3, who clearly wasn't working, but Russ is going to have more space and more shooting around him than he's ever had in his career. Early in the season, he was not taking advantage of it because he thought he was part of the shooting. Mm-hmm. Ned, to your point, now he is just driving and kicking or driving and finishing, and you're seeing the best version of Russ you've seen in a couple years. I think it's going to look really good in the regular season. I think the Rockets, it wouldn't shock me if they climb all the way to the 2 line. I don't think they will, but I think that's in play. What is concerning for them and what we won't know is when a team, especially a smart defensive team, has 2 weeks to drill down on exactly what you do poorly, how that's going to look in a playoff series.
But the performance last night and the win, that's going to build confidence for these guys because this is an experiment. Nobody knows how it's going to work, but being able to beat the team with the second best record in basketball on the road, that's huge.
He's already beaten you twice this year.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So, to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/FTF. netsuite.com/FTF. netsuite.com/FTF.
All right, on to the NFL now. And the latest turn in the Tom Brady saga, many have assumed it's Robert Kraft who's been the driving force trying to keep Brady in New England, and that Bill Belichick is ready to move on from him. But now we're hearing that might not actually be the case. Take a listen to Patriots insider Tom Curran appearing on WEEI in Boston.
From all I've gathered, Bill would prefer to have Tom Brady playing quarterback in 2020 because it's a known quantity and it removes the doubt. They're not ready to have him leave. But if he is going to leave and it's going to hamstring other portions, if it comes to a crossroads, I think Bill can easily get his mind around saying goodbye as well, as he has for so many players over the course of time. But I believe that his first preference would be to have it work out for another season with Tom.
What do you think about that? Surprise you a little bit?
No, of course he prefers to keep Tom Brady. I don't think anyone has argued that Belichick dislikes Brady, that Belichick thinks that Jared Stidham is better, that Belichick, even though there might be a part of Belichick that is excited about when Brady is finally actually done, being able to coach a team without Tom to see what it looks like, see what it feels like he did 20 years ago, see if he can have more success and remove any yeah, but from his resume. Yeah, but you only did it with Brady. But this is all about price. This is, of course, he prefers to keep Tom Brady at the right price. At least that's what I've always assumed. If Brady were to come and say, hey guys, I want to play for $12 million, then Belichick would have signed up for that instantly for this upcoming season. Now, would he give him a long-term extension? Would he tie the team to Brady for age 44, age 45? No, but this is, maybe I'm misreading it, the question a bit. This to me is obvious. Of course he prefers Brady over Andy Dalton, Marcus Mariota, Jared Stidham over the actual options, but that doesn't mean he needs Brady to the tune of letting him write his own check as far as what he's going to make next season from the team.
No, you're 100% right. This is what we all knew coming into this offseason. It was going to be cost-benefit analysis. What was the value proposition? How much was Tom Brady going to demand going into free agency? Tom Brady had the stipulation in his last contract where the team couldn't franchise him for a reason. He wanted to be able to command as much money on the open market as he possibly could. But I think the other thing that he wanted to do is to make sure that he had maximum leverage against the Patriots so he could dictate the terms under which a reunion would be possible. So I think a lot of this is about the Patriots respecting Tom Brady, but I think there's also a small part of it that's about Bill Belichick surrounding him with the requisite talent that it takes to maximize his abilities in the twilight of his career. So, I mean, Bill Belichick is ultimately going to have the final say with this whole deal, but I think that Tom Brady is putting a lot of pressure on him because he is a free agent and he's threatening to go other places to play. But I think in a perfect world, both of these two sides would like to get a deal worked out because I think it's in both best interests.
It is in both of their best interests. Are the Patriots ready to hand things over to Jarrett Stidham or Cody Kessler?
Man, stop.
That's not going to happen. Bill Belichick understands that you want to deal with the devil that you know. There's a bunch of things as a coach that you can't control. What are the young guys going to do? But you know exactly what Tom Brady's going to do. He's going to put up 4,000 plus yards. He's not going to throw a bunch of interceptions, and he's going to throw a bunch of touchdowns. No matter who you have at the quarterback position in New England, you're going to have to find people to put around him, no matter who that person is. So why wouldn't you go with the greatest of all time, Tom Brady? Here's the other part. Think about this. Tom Brady absolutely has the leverage. You're at a point where you have Lamar Jackson, you have Patrick Mahomes, you have Deshaun Watson in your conference. You can't beat those guys, those teams, even if you have the best defense in the league without Tom Brady. So if you're Bill Belichick, there's no thought process about him. You have to try to figure out, is it 30? Is it 33? Is it 35? What's the number that we can find that we can keep Tom Brady? Because him going elsewhere and the Patriots still winning, that's not going to be an option.
It feels like, though, it's not about money. It's not about, is that you think that the one thing Brady wants more than anything else? They have no contingency plan right now, the Patriots, or seemingly none. Brady, if you're going to say at the right price, well, then he better take that money and spend on someone for Brady to throw the ball to. Isn't that what Brady really wants, like actual weapons, more than he wants to fair market value?
I'm not sure exactly what Brady wants right now, other than I think he's enjoying the courting period that he's never really had at any point in his career and the attention that goes along with it. And I don't begrudge him that. I don't think it's just about the money for Brady. It is absolutely about the money for the Patriots. If there were no salary cap, this is not a discussion. If there were no other needs on the team, this is not a discussion. And if Brady were saying, guys, I'll just play for the minimum, then this is not a discussion. For the Patriots, for Belichick, this is exclusively about money. This is about he has a value in his head on every player. He always has. It's why you let great players walk. It's why when Randy, coming off the 07 record-breaking season, 08, he's good. 09, he starts asking for more money, and they trade him away. Not because Randy couldn't play anymore. Not because Brady didn't like Randy. Because there is a certain dollar amount Belichick attaches to every player on the roster, and if you get above that, he will very cold and calculatedly move on from you. For Tom, if he had full faith, Jenna, that money he doesn't take
will go towards someone else
that will help him, I think that's one thing. I don't know if he has that faith with the Patriots right now.
But why wouldn't he? They went out and tried to get N'Keal Harry. They did that. Mm-hmm. They tried to get Mohamed Sanu. They did that. They went out and got Antonio Brown. They did that. All those things are designed to help Tom Brady. So to me, if I'm Tom Brady, I already know that they're willing to help me. They're already willing to put the right players in place. The problem was Antonio Brown, he got kicked out of there. Mm-hmm. N'Keal Harry did not perform well. He started the year on the PUP, the pup list. Yep. And so at that point, Mohamed Sanu gets together in the trade, and he just didn't produce. They tried to bring players into New England. They just didn't produce. That's the holdup. So if I'm Tom Brady, I'm not saying whether they will bring people there because they already did that. To me, I'm saying, hey, I want to get paid and I want you to bring people here.
Well, I think Tom Brady wanting to get paid has a lot to do with the organization and, more importantly, Bill Belichick showing him the respect that he feels like he deserves. I think that's where it begins and ends for him. Clearly, Bill Belichick prioritizes winning. Both of these guys prioritize winning over everything else. But that doesn't mean that that's the only agenda that they have as they move into this stage of their respective careers. For Bill Belichick, he wants to catch Don Shula. Right now, he's 55 regular season wins away from catching Don Shula. Does Tom Brady give you a better chance of doing that?
No doubt.
Or the options on the free agent market or in the trade market? For Tom Brady, he wants a chance to be able to continue to brand the TB12 method, and having success in his 40s as a quarterback in the NFL helps him to continue to do that. But you got to have the right organization around you to be able to put yourself in a situation where you can win at the highest level. Do you have a better chance doing that in New England with Bill Belichick or somewhere else? I mean, when you ask those questions, the answers seem fairly obvious. These two should come back together. I think it will happen. And mixed up in all of this is Robert Kraft, who said that he wants Tom Brady back. So ultimately, after these two sides get done doing the dance, they'll eventually come back together.
I think you're right, though. I think he's enjoying all of this.
Of course he's enjoying all this.
Very much enjoying the non-decision.
And I do just want, if if Brady doesn't win a Super Bowl this year either way, whether he's with the Patriots or not, I do wonder if going somewhere else and putting up big numbers helps him enhance that TB12 method a little bit more.
Maybe. All right, on to the Warriors. Yesterday, they traded D'Angelo Russell to the Timberwolves for Andrew Wiggins, a 2021 top three protected first rounder, and a 2022 second round pick. The Golden State Warriors are 12-40. The Golden State Warriors have the worst record in the NBA.
Okay, hold on. Go ahead, Jenna. Sorry.
I'm just curious what you made of all this. You didn't like the trade?
Listen, admittedly, while I love the NBA, I love it. I have been in full football mode for about 4 months now. Obviously, even more so with my hometown Chiefs playing in the Super Bowl. I just got back from Miami. So maybe I've been a little disconnected. So I do have to ask our NBA insider and also boxing insider Chris Mannix a question. Is there another Andrew Wiggins in the league? Are there two guys? Is it guys like with the same names? Or is this the guy that was the number one pick for the Cavs, traded for Kevin Love, and has arguably the worst contract in the sport?
Same guy.
That's the guy? Man, we are light years away from the Warriors being light years ahead of the whole rest of the league. The hell you doing, Bob Myers? The next time Steph Curry takes the court, he's going to be 32 years old because he had a hand amputation, evidently. It is the world's worst hand injury we've ever seen. You have two untradeable contracts now. Draymond's 4 for 100. Draymond has specific value for your team. I'm not saying Draymond's a bad player. I'm saying, even if he's a good player, that contract is not movable because he's unique to what you do with Steph and Clay. Wiggins is horrifying. All the smart numbers show you he's never been contributing factor to winning at any point in his career, except for 10 games to start this season, and then he went right back to being Andrew Wiggins. What they did here was they traded the better player, and D'Angelo Russell's not a perfect player, but when they got him, we knew it was to flip him at some point, right? They traded a better player on a bad contract for a worse player on a bad contract, and they got a pick back. That needs to have gone the other way. You flip D'Angelo plus your pick coming this year, this offseason, for a contributor now. By the time LaMelo Ball or whomever the hell you draft this year is ready to compete, Steph's going to be 36 years old and you're done. I cannot. This is the most shocking NBA trade as far as that. What are you thinking in recent memory? There have been shocking trades. Like, I didn't see Paul George getting traded, but I understood the logic of it. Can you help elucidate this for me? Like, what is the logic of this if you're Golden State?
No, I don't like this trade at all for Golden State for a lot of the same reasons you just articulated there. I off the top, I love this trade for Minnesota because now you're the rebuilding Timberwolves. You've got Towns. You've got Russell. Great relationship with those two guys. You are starting the process of digging your way out of this hole. But my whole thing with D'Angelo Russell was, hold on to him through the trade deadline. Minnesota's thirst for D'Angelo Russell was
not going anywhere.
Like they have been pursuing him for 7 months. They would have pursued him for 3 or 4 more. You wait that out. If you still want to trade him, make the same deal, that would still be on the table. But by taking Russell out of the equation, you remove yourself from the possibility of going big game hunting this offseason. Russell has proven in two different systems that he is an all-star caliber player. He was in Brooklyn, and in a different system in Golden State, I thought he was really good so far this year. So if you get to the end of the season, and let's say the lottery ping pong balls go your way, you get the second pick in the draft.
Sure.
You can take D'Angelo Russell and the second pick in the draft and see what's out there. See what's available.
Of course.
Nick? We just talked about Ben Simmons and Philadelphia. What happens if they fizzle out in that first
round? Of course.
You can go to Philadelphia and say, hey, D'Angelo Russell and the second pick in the draft. You can draft Anthony Edwards. You can draft James. You can do whoever you want. And you can have a point guard who might fit better playing alongside Joel Embiid. Without it, you have Wiggins, who is not going to have anywhere near the same value in that type of trade.
Wiggins is a bad basketball player. He's owed $95 million over the next 3 years, starting next year. It's unspeakable they did this. People think I dislike the Warriors. There's things they've done that have irritated me. But going into this year, I said I thought they could be the sixth seed. I thought that if Clay came back at the end of the season, they could be dangerous. And that starting next year, we'll see if they can rejuvenate the old Splash Brother 15-16 team and be dangerous. It's over for them now. We will never see Steph in another NBA Finals, ever. They have no path forward. Draymond's 30. Klay's 30. Steph's about to be 32 when he takes the court again in mid-March, one would assume. They are Draymond, Wiggins, Klay, and Steph next year, $128 million for the cap. Cap's 115. They have no way to get better now. And you can say, oh, well, now they have their top five pick. If Minnesota's terrible next year, a good pick there. Man, young players do not help you in the playoffs, unless you're the Raptors. The last young player to make a big impact in the NBA Finals prior to the Raptors was Kawhi 7 years ago. I can't believe Bob Myers did this. I'm shocked that they went this route instead of what you're saying. Take your own pick, pair it with your best asset that you actually might move, and try to get someone that can help you. I would have loved to see Steph Curry's live reaction to this because he now has to go play with Andrew Wiggins.
There's got to be a little bit of schadenfreude there for Nick. You've always been sort of...
Well, yeah, but I would have liked to see them again have it like with the old... the pre-KD Warriors, and I guess we'll see it, but Andrew Wiggins going to be out there taking terrible long twos.
That's their point. They're hoping Andrew Wiggins becomes Harrison Barnes and that they can put together a finals type of team. I'm skeptical for the same reasons you are, but maybe a change of scenery changes Wiggins. I doubt it, but that's the only thought.
It's 6 years in.
I honestly haven't seen you this fired up about anything. What Giannis did in the East.
It's just insane.
Let's move on to Los Angeles now. Yesterday, we reported an arms race between the Clippers and the Lakers over the services of Knicks forward Marcus Morris. And the Clippers went out and got him, all part of a three-team deal with the Knicks and the Wizards. As for the Lakers, they decided to stay put, reportedly refusing to part ways with Kyle Kuzma or Danny Green. Mannix, are the Clippers now the best team in L.A. after what happened yesterday?
No, I think they're on the same level as the Lakers because, I mean, Kawhi and Paul George versus LeBron and AD, I mean, it's kind of a coin flip at this point. Might depend on the supporting cast around them. The Lakers would have been bonkers to make that deal. If the Knicks turn around, and they did ask for Kyle Kuzma and they wanted Danny Green, if the Lakers made that deal, what are you doing? I like Marcus Morris. He has been excellent this year, 44% from three. But you don't trade a proven playoff two guard in Danny Green, who is like the perfect role player out there. And you don't just dump Kyle Kuzma for 1 year of Marcus Morris. So this kind of went, Nick, how I thought it would go yesterday. Sitting here talking about this, the Clippers had these two assets. They had the contract of Harkless, and they had that first round pick burning a hole in their pocket. They made the deal to get in, to get him in that place. Yep. So now they get a guy that can help.
Yep.
But I don't know if it changed the dynamic significantly in the conference.
All right, so I'm further down on the Clippers than just about anybody. The Clippers got better. Mm-hmm. Marcus Morris, I don't think the 44%, the league's second best high volume 3-point shooter, is sustainable. But 38% certainly is. It's what we've seen over a number of years for him. That helps. During the regular season, where I think in the West seeding matters, when, you know, Kawhi takes 1-4 games off and Paul George is, you know, deals with nagging injuries, having Marcus Morris there will help you. And come the playoffs, I watched for your beloved Boston Celtics, Marcus Morris, not give LeBron problems, but not back down.
Not afraid of
him.
He's
a big guy. He's tough. He and his brother are real legitimate NBA tough guys. And so this does help the Clippers. I'm not going to sit here and act like the Lakers are lucky they didn't get him. No, he would have helped the Lakers. But this doesn't fill the single real need for the Clippers in my mind, which is rim protection. And it doesn't fill anything of a need for the Lakers. The last thing they need is another front court player. What they need is a ball handler, playmaker, or shooter, preferably all of the above. And if they can get Darren Collison for nothing, then the Lakers, to me, actually, they didn't necessarily add the better player, but they did more to improve their team. The question for the Lakers is this. You know, not just because he has hair now like Eminem once did, but will the real Kyle Kuzma please stand up, or is he already standing up? Last night he got two baskets. They were both spoon-fed to him by LeBron. He caught LeBron, got him the ball at the rim, and he finished. Kuzma is going to have to figure out, can he play on both ends of the court with the requisite maturity and intensity that is going to be needed to be in the playoff rotation? That is the first question for the Lakers. The second question for the Lakers is this. Can Frank Vogel have the stomach to do something that last year Luke Walton did not? Sit Rajon Rondo down. They can't survive the Rondo minutes. And if they get Collison and he takes Caruso's minutes instead of Rondo's minutes, that will be a disaster. Right, last night, they lose the game by 10. They're minus 14 in Rondo's minutes, in his limited minutes. Rondo might be a good locker room guy. People might like him. He's not an effective player for the Lakers. He never has been. So those, to me, are the bigger questions. For the Clippers side of things, they got better, and Harkless was doing nothing for him. So I think it's a smart move by them. I don't think it's a huge move.
And I think, look, I'm with you on the Rondo minutes needing to be cut. I think Caruso should be getting all of them at this point. And if you bring in Darren Collison, that's where those minutes should ultimately come from. I don't have confidence with 2 months to go in the regular season that Kyle Kuzma is going to figure it out.
Nope.
That all of a sudden it's going to click and he's going to be the third option that they so badly need. The biggest problem he runs into is that the way Frank Vogel sets his rotation, it's never Kuzma out there alone as the leader of the second unit, because they always have either LeBron or Anthony Davis on the floor. And when one of those two guys is on the floor, Kuzma's still in that same position looking for offense. Now, I thought Frank has done some nice things around the fringes, trying to run more plays for Kuzma, get him going. But Kyle Kuzma, his first couple of years in the league, was just like this volume scorer. He was on bad teams, and he was allowed to chuck up a bunch of shots, and it didn't really have any consequences. Now, he's asked to be more of a selective shooter, a spot-up three-point shooter, and right now, that's not his game. I'm not convinced, Nick, that it can never be his game. I think he's young enough and talented enough that if you give him another couple of off seasons, he could develop into that type of guy. But for this season, short-term, I just don't see it.
Do the Lakers feel like they sort of untapped potential with Kyle Kuzma? Would they have given up Kyle Kuzma if Danny Green wasn't attached to that?
I think they would have. If they would have been Kyle Kuzma and Quinn Cook and Jared Dudley, like contracts to make it work, I think they do it. I think because they are in win right now mode, the only hope for Kuzma, I shouldn't say the only hope, the best hope for Kuzma is, now trade deadline's over, he knows he's going to be there, that is
all the
a
uncertainty
moment,
is gone.
Right, that's a moment of, okay, I have to do my best to make this work. I just don't, all his friends got traded away. Honestly, like, who does he hang with? Who does he play Xbox with? Like, these are real things for a young NBA guy living in LA, trying to figure it out. And I think it's been tough on him. And I think for guys, as I said yesterday, when you have not yet been paid, you have guys in your ear telling you, man, the way to get paid is to score. And for Kuzma, what he's going to have to realize is the way to get paid is to be on a champion. If you're on a champion and you have two good moments in an NBA Finals can get you paid as much as two good months on a bad team.
Yeah.
I don't know if he recognized that. But now he's on the Lakers. He's going to be on the Lakers. See if he can make the most of it.
Here with a couple guys named Chris, Mannix, and Canty, and we're talking Kevin Durant. Ever since leaving the Thunder for the Warriors, he's had a, let's call it a contentious relationship with the media. Earlier this week, he joined Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson's show All the Smoke and gave
us
this
they call it that.
Insightful
Come on,
nugget.
Man.
I think the reason why all this expletive is going on, I think a lot of the media feel like they're bullying me. They want to bully me, and they feel like they found a little crackle or crease in my armor, and they want to use that against me somehow, so they continue to just regurgitate the same old stories, the same old storyline, and, you know, recreate beefs with players and former teammates. Nick, Kevin Durant feels like he's getting bullied. What do you think?
KD, man. I'm technically a millennial. I'm on the older, the upper bound of millennials.
We both are.
And sometimes millennials get a bad rap, and I try to defend them to my older friends like Jenna.
Hey.
And but now you've got a NBA superstar saying that Bill Plaschke's bullying him. Come on, man. And the media blaming here, here's the other hard truth for Kevin. Everything we said was correct. Every step of the way, the stuff that KD got the angriest about, we now know, thanks to his own words, are exactly how it went down. That he was checked out on OKC during his final year there, already thinking about his next move, up to and including during the 3-1 deficit. A few months ago, he went on Hot 97, said blowing that 3-1 lead was not even one of the five biggest losses of his career because he didn't think they were really a true championship contender. What? You're up 3-1 on 73-win team. That's Kevin's words. It's not me bullying to bring up your words. And then in this interview, when it came to OKC, he talked about how he looked at the Warriors that year as a new, fresh team on the rise. Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose they had just won the championship, and he was excited about living in the Bay. And then also on this podcast, he talked about how he knew about midway through the year that he was moving on from Golden State. That's all we were saying. That it is the fact that it was accurately reported is not bullying. The fact that everything that the media has, I shouldn't say everything, the vast majority of things the media has said is going on with Kevin Durant has proven out to be accurate is not bullying. It's accurate reporting. And the victim complex of, oh, woe is me, him also saying in this podcast, Mannix, this, you guys didn't try to do this to LeBron, Wade, and Bosch. First of all, LeBron, Wade, and Bosch had it worse than any team ever initially. But the reason they weren't trying to tear him apart was because there wasn't someone plotting an exit. Because they didn't handle it the way KD handled it. And so Steve Kerr has said he knew Kevin was floating away midway through the year. So I just, I don't understand the woe is me, everyone's against me, as opposed to just, man, I've made decisions. I'm accountable for those decisions, and I want to, for some reason, keep talking about those decisions like I'm the victim here.
Yeah, I think it's revisionist history to say that LeBron, Wade, and Bosch were not treated this way since they were crucified the first couple of years down there for putting that team together and being non-competitive, all the things that Kevin Durant was criticized for. I'm one of the media members that have covered Kevin virtually every step of the way in his career. I've never bullied him. I don't know too many people. I mean, maybe there's one or two people out there from the Oklahoma area that just don't like him because he left, but I don't think they've ever bullied him. He just never made the transition from what he was in Oklahoma City, this kind of revered figure that began in Seattle, stuck with his team all the way throughout, into just the mercenary for hire that he became in Golden State. He never understood why the criticism and why the villainy was so strong. The other thing he never, I think what a lot of this comes down to, and he's somewhat right about this, I don't think he gets the respect he deserves for the two championships they won in Golden State. I think, Nick, there are still people out there that would say, well, Golden State would have won without him. That is categorically untrue. The Golden State Warriors do not have those two championships without Kevin Durant. How he played in those finals was incredible. So if that's what he's fixated on, I get it. But everything else is just, as you said, accurately reporting every step of the way.
Yeah, and when there's an element of truth with something that's being said about you, that gets under your skin a little more than when it's something salacious that everybody knows that it's not you. But with Kevin Durant, this is just what comes along with being in the conversation as one of the best players in the world. I mean, you're focused on developing your brand. That's a big part of why you came to New York in free agency this past summer. I mean, if you want to have the show, the boardroom, and do all the other things off the court, if you want to make $30 to $40 million a year with your basketball salary, people are going to have questions about why you make certain decisions. And when you have the reporters accurately talking about what you're doing, your move that you plotted when you were at OKC to go to Golden State, and then your move to the East Coast this past summer, I don't understand why you're getting upset about it. People will want to talk about it because you are one of the best players in the world. So this is just par for the course. And when you're going back and forth with the media or with people on social media, you have to be willing to take it just like you're willing to dish it. And I just feel
like he wasn't just willing to dish it from his own account. Didn't he come up with phantom accounts so he could dish it? That is worthy of bringing up and talking about it. You don't, that's not bullying.
Well, I get, and that's the thing that bothers me with Kevin Durant. And I mean, listen, this is what it is. If you want to be on social media and you want to go take shots at people, people are going to take shots at you. But I don't think it's anybody trying to bully you. This is just what happens around sports because it's such a huge platform in our culture. So I just, for Kevin Durant,
this
I just
think embarrassing.
This is not something that you should be fixated
this
on.
This is embarrassing, is what it is. Listen, there is like an old school mentality of, oh, listen, being bullied is part of growing up. It makes you tougher. None of that. Miss me with that. We do have a bullying problem, right? And by the way, adults can bully other adults. It's a real thing. And I'm glad we're getting to a place where we are recognizing that and trying to do better, especially for young people. I mean that sincerely. But occasionally, my six-year-old comes home from school and says, I got bullied today. And I say, what happened? And what she means is someone was a little mean to her. That's not bullying you. We know what bullying is. Kevin Durant seems to not understand that every other mainstream pro athlete, big time pro athlete, understands is, hey man, with the money and the fame and the and all of it comes some nonsense that you don't like. Yes, you are going to be talked about. Yes, you are going to be picked at. Yes, you are going to be inspected in a way that you wouldn't if you worked at Home Depot. And but you know what? There are a lot of good positives that go along with it. Everyone agrees with that. Everyone, whether it should be or shouldn't be, a huge part of the NBA's popularity are these are talking about these guys sometimes as three-dimensional figures, sometimes as two-dimensional figures. And calling that bullying is embarrassing. And I don't want to sound like a caveman, but it as a grown man, what are you talking about? Like you are super rich, super powerful, super successful, and the beat writer from the Oklahoman is bullying you? Get out of here. Like I know Matt a little bit. I know Steven Jackson a lot. I would have loved to know what Action Jack is thinking while KD's sitting there saying, I'm being bullied by a guy who makes 42 grand a year writing game stories. Yeah. Give me a break.
Well, I mean, look, and bullying is not 280 character critiques on Twitter, especially when you can walk away from that. You don't have to log on. You don't have to put your mentions on. There are a whole bunch of things you can do. I think, again, it comes back to the turn he made from hero to villain was so fast and so bad at that time, because he went from, you know, an Oklahoma City team where he was revered to the worst possible situation you can go to if you still want to be beloved. A 73-win Golden State Warrior team. You can't make a turn like that as bad as it could be.
I'm right there with you. And the one thing I look at with this situation, the decision that he made this summer, it wasn't what was in his basketball best interest. You can't say he was putting himself in a better situation going from Golden State, where they're moving to a new arena, when you have Klay and Steph Curry, to the Brooklyn Nets, even though you have Kyrie coming with you. This was about things that were off the court, another agenda that he had, and a part of the media coverage for the NBA enables him to be able to do all of those things. So you can't have it both ways.
And
in
I don't even
opinion.
Care about guys like, you know, LeBron going where he went, Kevin Durant, they're free to go where they want to go, but this comes with it. Like, this
that's
comes
the
with
point.
The turn.
That's the point.
How about stop talking about it? How about stop talking about it, Kevin Durant? The more you talk about it, the more it's brought up, then the more you complain about being. Jimmy Garoppolo, the Niners quarterback, did go 13-3 this season, leading San Francisco to the Super Bowl, yet finds himself as the target of some scrutiny, perhaps because he averaged less than 150 yards per game in the playoffs. Hey, whether or not you think he's the long-term answer in the Bay Area, his coach certainly does. Take a listen.
I think Jimmy's one of the main reasons we got to the Super Bowl. I think he overcame a lot. This was his first year in his career going through an entire NFL season. He still doesn't have as many starts and stuff as Baker Mayfield. I think he had a hell of a first year truly playing the position. He was on his way close to Super Bowl MVP. And we all know we didn't make those plays at the end, but we made those plays all year, our whole team. That's one of the reasons we were there. And whenever you don't make those plays at the end in a game like that, first and foremost, the quarterbacks can get attacked, and then usually the play caller. So we understand that's how it goes.
Nick, you think Jimmy Garoppolo has another Super Bowl run in him next season?
Sure, just like they did this year. I mean, I don't think Jimmy Garoppolo is going to get much worse next year. I don't think he's going to be an inferior player to what he was this year. I don't think he's going to take the leap a lot of people expect young quarterbacks to take, because he ain't young. He's inexperienced. He's 28 years old. Like, the idea that he didn't learn the beginning football knowledge he's going to learn from those years under Brady, the years in that system, the years in San Francisco, I don't put him in the same bucket that I put first or second or third year quarterbacks who haven't been in an NFL system, for as long as he has been. But the exact same way they made the Super Bowl this year. Quarterback, be a caretaker. Kyle Shanahan draw up some brilliant offensive plays and scheme guys wide open. And Jimmy, try not to screw it up. Like, I think he is in a perfect position given his skill set, but I don't think all of a sudden if they make the Super Bowl again, it's going to be because Jimmy Garoppolo is fantastic because he takes some major leap. He can clean a few things up, but I think at 28 years old, you usually are basically who you're going to be.
That's true. That's true. If he played, this is his first full season starting, only 26 games under his belt. But I want to give you some stats, and these are quarterbacks that we all know: Tom Brady and Big Ben in their first playoffs as starters. Jimmy G, he's 2-1. We obviously know that. Tom Brady 3-0. Big Ben 1-1 in his first playoff starting. Yards per pass 7.4 for Jimmy G, 5.9 for Tom Brady, 7.5 for Big Ben. And then when you look at the completion percentage, Jimmy G has better completion percentage than both of those guys. And so I think that he has the ability to get better. If he just doesn't throw the ball to the other team, they certainly have an opportunity to. Well, yeah, that is a big if, but I think experience allows you to not see those same things and say, okay, I'm not going to make that same type of mistake. You made a great point. If you have the same defense, if you have a great running game, and if you believe in Kyle Shanahan being this young, innovative head coach, then Jimmy G should be a better quarterback next year than he was this year. And with all those things put together, I think they certainly can make a Super Bowl run.
Yeah, you bring up some great points, B. You're talking about quarterbacks in the postseason with relatively no experience or very little experience going into those situations. They're more passengers than they are difference makers. But, Jimmy Garoppolo is not Pat Mahomes. We know he doesn't have that type of ceiling. But Jimmy Garoppolo is an ascending player, even though he's been in the league 6 years. He's only got 29 starts. So we'd be foolish to think that there isn't an opportunity for him to improve, because his overall knowledge is going to take a jump because he's got actual experience on the field being able to operate the offense. It's different when you're the guy under center versus being the guy on the sideline with the clipboard. So he is going to improve. We don't know how dramatic that improvement is going to be. But when you look at the situation that the 49ers are in, I mean, they're coming off of a 12-loss season, and they make a run to the Super Bowl. I mean, there's been only one team in the Super Bowl era that's ever done that, and that was the greatest show on turf, the 99 Rams. And guess what? They made a Super Bowl appearance a couple of years later after that. So, I mean, there's opportunity that the 49ers have. And when you look at what the 49ers used in order to acquire Jimmy Garoppolo, they gave up a second-round pick, and they guaranteed him $74 million on a contract extension, and he's at a relatively reasonable price over the course of the next 3 years. I think it's cap hits of $26 million, $27 million, and $27 million. So as far as the economics of the position go, that's a good deal. And I think it's one that will allow John Lynch to put the requisite talent around him in order to compete at the highest levels.
What don't you trust about Jimmy Garoppolo, Nick? There's something about him that you're not ready to run.
And he doesn't have a great arm.
But isn't that something? Is that something you can? If he could clean that up, how would you feel about Jimmy G?
I mean, if I were Canty size, I probably would have played sports at a higher level. I mean, I don't think he's going to.
Okay.
Listen. His first year in San Francisco, he played 5 games. He threw 5 picks. His second year in San Francisco, he played 3 games. He threw 3 picks. This year in San Francisco, he played 19 games. He threw 16 picks. I mean, the guy turns the ball over and is not asked to make very difficult throws. He is asked to play action pass, look, someone's usually running wide open, stick it. And he's still only, it was interesting, Shanahan brought up Baker. Only Baker had a pick in more games this year than Jimmy Garoppolo did. He had interceptions in the same number of games as Jameis Winston did. Now, he didn't have the 5 interception games like Jameis would, and I'm not saying he's that level of turnover machine, but by the way, he also doesn't have Jameis's arm. He doesn't have Jameis's ability to make all the throws. I feel like people are lying, not lying, but tricking themselves about what he is. Aaron Rodgers sat for 3 years. Mm-hmm. His first year starting struggled. His second year as a starter, his fifth year in the league, he was Aaron bleeping Rodgers. Give him 40 starts to figure out who he is, because you do learn in those first 3 years. You do get an ability to consume NFL offense, to figure out playbooks, things like that. I think the Niners can make the Super Bowl again with Jimmy Garoppolo because they just did it. I don't think he's going to all of a sudden be some top flight NFL quarterback.
Here's the thing. Jimmy Garoppolo is not in the same situation as a quarterback going in his second or third year. He's not on that street, but he's around the corner, because even though he's in year 6, he still only has 29 starts. So, I mean, listen, as you continue to play this game, your knowledge base continues to grow. I mean, that doesn't stop. Now, your athletic ability may diminish a little bit. That usually goes away on the latter part of your prime and toward the end of your career. But you never stop learning football. This is something that's always happening. You're always evolving in terms of your understanding of the game. And Jimmy Garoppolo has that opportunity. And let's not forget this. his team had a 10-point lead in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl. So this guy was good enough to put you in that situation. So you're going to have a chance to compete at a high level if they're able to make the numbers work and keep most of the core players intact under the salary cap. So I look at this situation as Jimmy Garoppolo, because of what they already have invested in him and the return on that investment that they've already seen, he's going to be their guy for the foreseeable future. It makes all the sense in the world.
He was good enough to win the Super Bowl for three quarters. He just wasn't able to do that fourth quarter, which is a big, big mistake and a big if. Here's the other part, and this is what I would be wondering if I'm Kyle Shanahan. If somehow defenses find a way to slow down our run offense, and if our defense isn't the best pass defense in the league, and maybe they don't get to the quarterback as well as they did this year, can Jimmy G carry us? That's the biggest question.
And the answer is no. The answer to that is no. We can say he gets better with experience. In his three most recent football games, the game against the Vikings, they're controlling the game, and he just hands the ball to Eric Kendricks. A mind-boggling throw, except he's done it throughout his career. Game against the Packers, they don't ask him to throw really at all the whole game. Against the Chiefs, he throws one pick with his eyes closed. Eyes closed, just throw it away. And then how did the three drives end that ended their season? Third and five, misses a wide-open George Kittle, instead sails over that of Kendrick Bourne. Next drive, misses a wide-open Emmanuel Sanders to potentially win the Super Bowl. Next drive, throws another pick. So, like, it's not like he's getting better at these things. It's not like, well...
Hold on. It was only his third playoff game, the Super Bowl you're talking about. He's never had playoff experience in the actual game under center before this year.
Fair enough. I'm simply saying, as far as he's had 29 career starts 27, 28, 29, we didn't see a big progression on the... What throw was that, Jimmy? I don't think we're going to see it 30, 31, 32.
With contract talks all but stalled with quarterback Dak Prescott, it is now being reported the team will likely use the franchise tag on him, but that might not solve all of their problems. According to Mike Florio, Dak may not show up this offseason without a new deal. Don't forget last season when Zeke would not show up without his new deal. Nick, should the Cowboys just pay Dak Prescott already to avoid a holdout and finally move on? It feels like this has been going on for 2 years now.
No, not if he wants to be paid top of the market when he's not a top of the market player, and he's not going to hold out. Listen, I cannot think of a single quarterback since Carson Palmer who has held out, and Carson wasn't holding out for new money. Carson was just like, man, I've got the Bengal blues and I need to get the hell out of here. Like, this is, quarterbacks play by a different set of rules. They get paid on potential rather than production. They make double what basically any other player except the very, very top flight defense pass rushers make in the league. And as what they give back is they never hold out. You don't have to worry about your quarterback holding out. Kirk Cousins could have held out. He didn't. Hell, Patrick Mahomes could right now say, guys, if you don't make me forget $40 million a year, $50 million a year, I ain't showing up. And the Chiefs would have to do it, he won't, so they don't need to. And Dax, I believe, overplaying his hand. I think he's overplayed his hand for a year now. Now, maybe it made him a little bit of money by how he played this season, but maybe not, because his best argument wasn't a statistical one. It was a wins-based one, and they didn't win enough this year. So I would rather deal with a Dak holdout, which I don't think is a real possibility, then deal with Dak Prescott at $36, $38 million per year.
Well, it's interesting that you frame it that way. You look at all the other quarterbacks around the NFL, and you don't typically see quarterback holdouts, but that's because organizations don't get to that point where their quarterback is going into a walk year.
Sure.
You typically don't see that. I mean, quarterbacks are almost like coaches in that regard. Teams are not going to let it get too far gone without addressing their contract, because you need stability at the top of the organization's hierarchy. With the Dallas Cowboys, you've seen everything that you could possibly see from Dak Prescott in terms of what you expected when you drafted him 4 years ago. He's exceeded expectations, and you had him on the cheap. And now it comes time to pay that bill, and ultimately you're going to have to do it because you don't have any other viable option. So to me, the Cowboys, their mistake was letting this thing go on as long as it did. They should have got this deal done before the Jared Goff contract and the Carson Wentz contract, two quarterbacks that were in Dak Prescott's draft class. The fact that they didn't have that happen, now they're going to have to pay Dak Prescott top of the market money, more money than those guys, and potentially more money than Russell Wilson.
They should have gotten the deal done. But, Nick, you mentioned that quarterbacks usually get paid off potential rather than production. Well, he certainly has potential, more potential to get better. He got much better between last year and this year, and the production is there. He's a second in the league in yards, fourth in the league in touchdowns this year. I mean, what more did the Cowboys actually want to see? They want him to be first in those categories? Absolutely not. The reason why quarterbacks you're talking about don't get into this position is because they're the face of the franchise. Usually they're the most stable person in the organization. And Dak is the leader of that huddle. He's been that way his entire career. He's won two out of the four times they're talking about the NFC title that he's played. So what do you mean that he shouldn't get paid? If I'm Jerry Jones, I'm saying I have to get this guy paid because what I don't want this season is something that I had earlier next season that I had this season. That means noise. I don't want to have to worry about guys holding out. I want the team together. We got a brand new coach. We want everything to be in place so we don't have to worry about those types of things because those things linger throughout the season. You don't want things to linger if you're Jerry Jones.
But to answer your question, Brian, what do I want to see? I want to see something I'm not going to see from Dak Prescott, which is if you want to be paid like you're one of the three best quarterbacks in football, show me you're at least one of the eight best quarterbacks. Show me you're at least one of the five best quarterbacks because we have seen a lot of different ways for teams to win Super Bowls. What we have not seen under the current salary cap era is a average to above average quarterback on a superstar's contract lead his team to a championship. We've seen mediocre to bad quarterbacks on the cheap do it. We've seen quarterbacks on rookie salary scales do it. And we've seen superstar quarterbacks paid like superstar quarterbacks do it. We haven't seen the Dak, the Kirk, hell, that you one could argue we almost just saw it with Jimmy G, but we didn't. And Jimmy G's contract these days is actually not top of the market anymore. A guy paid like he's great when he's not, being able to overcome it. That's my concern if I'm Dallas.
And if you look at the two Super Bowl quarterbacks this year, Jimmy Garoppolo and Patrick Mahomes, who is Dak Prescott closer to? And which way should he get paid? Closer to Patrick Mahomes or closer to Jimmy Garoppolo?
Well, if you wanted to pay him closer to Jimmy Garoppolo, you would have paid him last offseason. And that would have been the first priority that you had in that offseason. But instead...
I feel like they tried to, and then they made Zeke their priority, but he didn't want that.
Jenna, they tried to, but here's the thing. It would have certainly been cheaper, the deal that they would have came to terms to before Wentz and Goff and before Russell Wilson. All of those guys got paid last offseason. So if you didn't want to pay Dak Prescott $35, $36, $37 million a year, why didn't you offer him a contract paying him $33 million a year last year? That was the situation that the Dallas Cowboys should have addressed rather than addressing the Ezekiel Elliott contract. But now you're in a position where you're talking about franchising your quarterback and limiting the ability to make the other moves that you need to make this offseason. I mean, they've got $70 million in cap space, but that's going to go pretty quickly if you got a franchise Dak and you re-sign Amari Cooper. What are you going to do with Robert Quinn and Byron Jones? I mean, you're not going to be able to keep both of them.
Correct.
Not unless you structure Dak Prescott's extension where you can defer some of the compensation into future cap years. So I think the Dallas Cowboys have painted themselves into this corner. And now they have to deal with the reality that they're going to have to pay Dak Prescott something that's going to make Jerry Jones blush.
Nick, do LeBron and AD and company have enough to make a title run?
Oh, I think they absolutely have enough. I think that they are, though, missing a piece. I think that piece is going to come in the form of Darren Collison, which is this offseason, if you remember, once they missed out on Kawhi, the top two free agents I wanted them to go after were Danny Green and Darren Collison, with Seth Curry, not Steph Curry, Seth Curry mixed in there as well. Collison then retired, and so they made up where they could, the Avery Bradley move, some other smaller moves, Boogie Cousins, who obviously has done, got hurt and done nothing for him. As presently constituted, they have enough. But it is so much on LeBron's shoulders. Now, I think he can handle it because he's handled it throughout his career, and I think he will up his game in the postseason because he's done that throughout his career as well. But Darren Collison, to me, is a much better addition for them than Marcus Morris would have been. Marcus Morris helps the Clippers. It's a good move. I'm not going to act like the Lakers lucked out by not getting him, but I wouldn't have traded Kuzma and Danny Green for Marcus Morris ever. I think Danny Green is more valuable in the postseason than Marcus Morris will be. Kuzma, I have questions about. But if they don't get Darren Collison, will they still be my pick to make the NBA Finals out of the West? Yes. But LeBron's going to have to play 42 minutes a night, and they're going to have to solve their Rajon Rondo problem somewhere else.
Yeah, the margin for error for the Lakers is paper thin right now. I mean, you have got to be, LeBron's got to be great. Davis has got to be great.
And healthy.
And healthy. You know, everything's got to kind of click for them to get past those teams in the Western Conference, and then you get to the finals, and then you get Milwaukee. That's a separate conversation. I'm with you. I would not have made the deal if it meant Kyle Kuzma and Danny Green. I don't think that makes you better short or long term. Marcus Morris, a free agent at the end of the year. Danny Green signed to a two-year deal. Kyle Kuzma signed to a two-year deal. Collison interests me because if we're getting Darren Collison from the last 2 years, massive upgrade right away. But he hasn't played basketball since last spring. I don't get the sense, like Andre Iguodala, that he was working out every day in preparation for coming back to play. So I saw him sitting next to Jeannie Buslax last night. The eyeball test of the guy in a sweater. Look, he looks like he's in decent shape, but how long does it take Darren Collison to get into game shape? How effective can he be throughout the course of this season? I'm going to have to see that first before I believe he's a big upgrade over guys like Rondo and others.
Well, I think what you're looking for from Darren Collison is for him to be a factor in terms of being a ball handler, playmaker in the second half of the regular season. We know once we get to the postseason, that's going to be Bron. It's not going to be anybody else, but you got to get him there healthy. And right now with the usage and only having Alex Caruso as somebody that you can rely to spell him with the ball handling, I think that's the biggest thing. So, Jenna, the point you bring up about LeBron and AD's health is absolutely right. They don't have a huge margin of error. Those two guys have to be great in order for the Lakers to compete for a title. So I'm looking at this from the standpoint that you do have to find somebody, find a way to be able to get the ball out of LeBron's hands just so you can have him at his best when it matters the most. That's my biggest concern. Outside of that, I mean, would you like to have a little more perimeter shooting? Absolutely. You don't really have a lot of knockdown shooters on that roster. Danny Green, KCP, and you really don't have a lot of confidence in anybody else. But, I mean, I don't think that there was a deal to be made that you would feel comfortable with at the deadline, because I'm with you guys. I think the price of Kuzma and Danny Green would have been too much for Marcus Morris.
But Marcus Morris, while he doesn't give you rim protection for the Clippers, he gives you three guys that can guard LeBron James, which is really the conversation we're having now, is the Clippers and the Lakers.
Well, listen, 100%, Jenna, and I thought the Lakers were going to get Andre Iguodala. They didn't get him. They were in on Marcus Morris. They didn't get him. And so I'm not going to sit here and act like the trade deadline went the way the Lakers would have hoped. But I thought they were going to get Andre Iguodala for nothing. I thought he was going to be a buyout guy, and he ends up coming over. Instead, Memphis, to their credit, held on to him. And I like Justice Winslow. When he's healthy, he's a good player. So good for Memphis. It worked out for all parties involved. The asking price for Marcus Morris was too rich for my blood or the Lakers' blood. I wouldn't have traded Marcus Morris for Danny Green straight up. Even if he's a more effective regular season player, for what the Lakers need in the postseason, I trust Danny Green more. So obviously Green and Kuzma for Morris is something I wouldn't do. If they don't add Collison, then I do think there is a level of concern only in this regard. You mentioned it's going to be Bron in the playoffs. Yeah, for 40 minutes, maybe 42 minutes. Those other 6 or 8 minutes can ruin a game if it's Rondo. And Rondo last night played 14 minutes. They were outscored by 14 points. He has been an anchor around this team's neck for 2 years. And for some reason, neither coach, whether it was Walton or Vogel, seemed to understand that, or maybe they just don't trust Caruso enough. I feel like you would trust Collison to take those minutes from him.
You trust Collison, and he addresses the perimeter shooting problems because At his best, he is a terrific spot-up shooter. So if you want to create the lanes for LeBron and AD to do that, you have it. I do think, if you're the Lakers, without the Collison signed right now, you're cringing a little bit because of Marcus Morris, because the Clippers effectively gave up nothing. Harkless wasn't doing anything for them. A first-round pick, who cares, at least when it comes to this year. They got themselves a guy that makes shots, who's battle-tested in the playoffs, and as you said, can defend LeBron James. It almost increases the urgency to get Darren Collison in a uniform and get him part of that mix.
Right.
Well, real quick, do you have an apology, by the way?
For whom?
My guy, J.R. Smith. You were body shaming him yesterday.
I don't know. All the apologies to go around
He was in an ice tub with Kevin Hart. Yeah, he's not game ready.
Yeah. Oh, not game ready. Did you see he was getting a tryout this week with the Lakers?
When he signs.
Okay,
we'll talk.
I'm just saying, JR. You know who always had your back. He's out here body shaming you. I'm saying he could be a key piece off the bench for the Lakers.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern.